best. I think we're ready to begin now, and I would like to welcome everyone to this evening's event about Queering Islam, and I want to thank you for taking the time to attend. We'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are meeting for this important conversation here in Mi'kma'ki, the ancestral and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people, and I would like to invite John R. To say a few words. John R. is a two-spirited person and the co-founder of the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance.
Hi, everyone. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm John R. I just wanted to share a couple things. First of all, welcome our folks that are coming all the way from Toronto and as far as other areas. We call them Gamewa, people from the other side of the sea, or further on. And I just want to acknowledge that we are on unceded territory. As custom, and I think as tradition, and it's a great tradition, I welcome this very much by our LGBT community, which is our sister organization here in Halifax, and whoever works with our folks on this territory. We want to include a really inclusive process and make sure that we celebrate traditions that we have culture as well. So as a Mi'kmaq person, I'm in the process of learning about our culture. We have to be reacquainted with our culture. I speak Mi'kmaq, and my generation had lost a lot of our traditions that we didn't celebrate very openly with. But the great thing is generations that follow us have brought them and taken them back to the surface, which is great. I have nephews and nieces that dance, chant, drum, make regalia, and they're the ones that are bringing us back into the circle in the ceremonial process as well. So as a two-spirit person, we would have normally had been involved in ceremonies and traditions and everything else that takes place in our communities. As cultural attachés, that's what I say in the English language that we would use, or even the French language, we would have welcomed people into our ceremonies. We would have welcomed people into this dialogue. And we would have started off with some sort of traditional event. So you all know what this is. All right, so I picked this last year with some elders from our Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance that we were walking around looking for medicines. And we found this at the, we've known this to exist long before the Pagus Cove Lighthouse was there. But it's still a place where we go and we still pick our medicines from there. So you can pick this, and a lot of people don't know this, so you get to Pagus Cove, and you see the lighthouse over there, but you see the swampy area that's over to your left, and everything, that's where you'll see the sea grass. It's tall, like the sea grass about this high, and what you do is you pick it from the root, and you pull it out. So you'll notice it's sea grass, and you can smell it, and you smell it around the area. So if you go there next time, look for that around the summertime, right? So mid-June, late June, and early August, you see that. Take it home, braid it, dry it up. You can moisten it so that you can use it. So this is a year old already. I've used it at the vigil. I've used it at another occasion, and it's part of something. So I'm glad to be using it again today, and I welcome the fact that you had invited us. So I'm going to light it and share it. So really what you do is you can smudge yourself. So what you do is you smudge yourself, starting with your head, where all the information comes in, where you hear, where you see, where you speak. You bring it into your body, then you bring it into your heart, right? And you bring it to the rest of your body where your blood flows. And then you usually have someone that can do your smudging in the back as well. So somebody would be smudging that with a feather. So it's a good way, it's a good opportunity for people to know that. And if you're not Aboriginal, it doesn't matter. I mean, smudging is a good thing to do as a cleansing process and just to feel peace with yourself. So I'm gonna go ahead and smudge. And I think I had
layers
somewhere.
Can you lend the layer? Small pink one. There we go.
I found it. I found
there we go.
It's pink.
Of course it is.
On Wednesday,
it's
my birthday. We're going to smoke them. So hopefully the fire alarm doesn't go off. So you can smell it. So what you do is you try not to, you don't want it to burn right off because it's got a little bit of moisture. So I wet it every time that I use it. So basically what you do is you go around the room, And I'll have you guys use it. So people will share maybe a chant with it. People will say a prayer. People will dedicate in a word to the ancestors. People will also talk about how we are here to talk about something as important as this. It's a spiritual journey for us, and it's a ceremonial process. So it's important that we recognize that and keep an open mind. This keeps your cleansed, your soul cleansed, and your spirit cleansed. So that's part of the process. You keep that open mind throughout the end, and usually an elder would be doing this, and at the end, an elder would be close to the ceremony. But it would be an open process, and you guys take it with you. All right. So I'm going to pass it around so you guys can smell it at least. All right. Thank you very much, and I welcome you to our territory. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you to John Barr. And while that's going around the room, I'll take some time to introduce our speakers and talk about what we're here for this evening. And I guess I should start by introducing myself. My name is Sailaja Krishnamurthy. I'm a new faculty member at St. Mary's, and I'm so grateful to be here and sharing this conversation with you. Some of you know I moved here like a couple weeks ago. And so it is amazing to be in this room with all of these people and to have this opportunity to learn with you. So I'd like to thank the folks who organized this event, and on their behalf, I would also like to do a few other thank yous. I'd like to thank the Nova Scotia Rainbow Action Project, Queer Arabs of Halifax, the El Tawhid Jumma Circle, and the Center for Interdisciplinary Study of Culture at St. Mary's University. We also want to acknowledge the generosity of St. Patrick's, who offered this space to us free of charge in the spirit of interreligious learning. And a special thank you to Dr. Mavi Abdelmasi, who did the legwork to make space for this conversation. So we have three, now we have a fourth panelist joining us, which is wonderful, and I think I should move this up a little bit. I'm going to just introduce the panelists to you, and then I'm going to ask them to each come up in turn and share their contributions. Our first panelist is Troy Jackson. Troy is a Toronto-based but Truro-raised artist. He and his husband, Alfred Kaki, run a law practice, are co-owners of the Glad Day Bookstore in Toronto, and most importantly for tonight, they're the co-founders, along with Dr. Lori Silvers, of the El Tawhid Jumma Circle Mosque in Toronto. So Troy is going to give a short performance entitled, I think it's Inshallah, and then we'll talk about his experience of finding Islam. And then next, I'm going to invite Al-Farouk Kaki to speak. Al-Farouk is the imam of the El Tawhid Jumma Circle Mosque and is an immigration lawyer and activist. Along with his husband Troy, who is one of the most powerful Muslim voices in the wake of the tragedy in Orlando. Al-Farouk is also currently completing his master's in the program for pastoral studies at the University of Toronto. And Al-Farouk will discuss his experiences as an imam and his particular approach to liberation theology. And then next I will invite Dr. Syed Adnan Hussain to share some of his thoughts with you. Adnan is an assistant professor of religious studies at St. Mary's. His research touches on a number of Muslim issues, including political organizations, sexual politics, and hip-hop. He frequently teaches classes that are free and open to the public, such as the Islamic Religious Tradition course at St. Mary's campus this fall. So Adnan is going to talk about the idea of queering Islam, starting with a quick scriptural historical overview. I never think quick when I hear scriptural historical overview. I'm expecting a lot by some suggestions for thinking of Islam as inherently queer. And then, sort of at the last minute, we've dragged Zan up here, and so I'd like to briefly introduce him to you. So Zan is a public school teacher in Bridgetown. So she's a Muslim woman teaching grades 7 to 12 in a small community. And she's also the GSA facilitator in her school. And so she's here to talk about her experience as a Muslim woman and as an ally and working with young people as well. Great. Following these presentations, we're going to have a Q&A, which I think promises to be really rich, and we're going to invite all of you to ask questions if you have them. I have a few in mind myself, and I have, just something that I think we should be thinking about as we enter into this conversation, and that is to really think about what's happening with our panel and with all of the topics that we're going to be talking about here in terms of gender. What does it mean to meaningfully make space to talk about queer Muslim women's experiences? And what does it mean to have this conversation with three and now four cisgendered people talking about their experiences as Muslims? I think we need to talk a little bit about gender and representation and sexual politics, and I want that to sort of sit with people as we're sort of continuing the conversation here. So, and then I'm sure there are many other questions that are going to be bubbling up for people. So without further ado, then I'm going to invite Troy to begin.
Okay. Thank you.
Sometimes I found the most interesting forms of prayer in lyrics. I do. I'm a performer. This song is not my lyrics, but this song is by a group called Slick Idiot. And they're a German sort of hard electro band, and they're amazing. And I had the pleasure to meet the writer of the song a couple years ago. They came to stay with us in Toronto. And I said, I really love the lyrics, I'm going to take this song. So I took this song, and this is my cover. It's called Inshallah, which is God willing. And it goes like this. You are my strength. You are my stronghold. You are my comfort, my confidence. I am only a guest on this earth. Sometimes I feel depressed by the weight of all our sins. My soul is crying for love. Stop now and spread the words of love. It's too late, we've lost the war, you need me. You need mine, and I need your support. We're all the same. We're all the same in the eyes of God. Inshallah, we will love ourselves. Inshallah, we will escape this living hell. Inshallah, we learn to feel and understand. Inshallah, we will get another chance. Letting go, letting go is to renew. Don't hate, no, nevermore. Yes, we all need your help. More than ever before. Yes, you give birth to your own destiny. Yes, you are in control. God's ideal is overthrown. 'Cause God is great. God is great. No one else can take your place. Inshallah, we will love ourselves. Inshallah, we will escape this living hell. Inshallah, we learn to feel and understand. Inshallah, we will get another chance. We will get another chance. We will get another chance.
Time of the year. Make sure you get up and see this beautiful program.
performance, please. I want to acknowledge my auntie who's here, Heather. And this is my twin brother, Todd. So we're the Jackson twins from Truro. When we used to live there, it was a town of twins. I went to school with probably, what, seven other sets of twins. So Truro, Nova Scotia, we're representing here today. Yes. So my journey to Islam. Me standing up here, I represent a bunch of intersectionalities. So I say that I stand at an intersection of I'm Afro, I'm Métis. That's part of my history here in Nova Scotia. I'm gay and I'm Muslim. Now why, my brother asked me most recently, he said, why did you convert to Islam for? Really? Why? And I said, well, Todd, I said, for me, I always respond to the call. So I'm going to move this, actually. I respond to tones. I respond to words. I respond to feeling. That's why I'm here, and that's why I converted to Islam. I was called to Islam by the call to prayer. The call to prayer actually called me. The beautiful recitation that I heard hit me tonally that I haven't been hit before, except for one time before, when I was in Vancouver at a hip-hop show. And the artist sang this beautiful, you know, I was talking to my friends, you know, she's just warming up the crowd a little bit, and she sang this, and she said, can you all feel me way down here? And when she hit that last note, we all stopped, all five of us, and we looked at each other, and we just got up together, and we went towards the stage. I never had a feeling, ever, except for when I heard the really beautiful call to prayer, and it called me. I always consider myself a really spiritual person. My background is I'm Baptist, and so for me, I was actually trying to search for something different, because for me personally, I didn't always jive with my sensibilities of being born a sinner, frankly. And so for me, what I really love about Islam is that we're not born sinners, we're born forgetful. So humankind's born forgetful. And that really jived with my feelings, because for me also, if we're coming from perfection, so something more vast than me, the world, the universe, that's responsible for me being here, I sometimes don't have the words to explain God, but if I come from God, from perfection, into this reality through a woman, I'm going to try to respect that too as well. So for instance, when people say to me, why did you convert to Islam? It's so, I say, hold on a second. My Islam actually expanded my view of the world. It didn't narrow it, it expanded it. Alfred and I recently went to Spain, for instance, and so I've seen Spain through a Muslim lens, so through Muslim Spain, through the history of Muslim Spain, I saw Spain. And also too as well, I can go there and hear the bus tour, where they say, and Christopher Columbus went off to discover America. And I'm like, ah, you're still selling that lie there, because my people were here as well before Christopher Columbus was lost and came here. So I see the world that way. My community that I converted to was very, full of scholars and thinkers and people that really challenge each other. And so, to answer your question, Todd, I converted to Islam because I converted to a beautiful community. Right? I've been very blessed to have people in my life like Imam Dai Abdallah, for people like Musin Hendricks in Cape Town, Dr. Amin Wadood, Scott Kugel. These are really beautiful friends of ours. So if I have something that I want to really discuss or get into with Islam, for instance, I have to ask those folks, this lovely man, or my lovely well-schooled husband, right? I'm going to ask questions, because also for me, Islam is peacemaking, active peacemaking. And that's a challenge, because sometimes actively making peace, for me and how I view that, is actually challenging sometimes, because also I have to deal with my own preconceptions of people, my own prejudices because of my own background and my own life experience. That's very different from everybody in this room, including my brother. My twin brother. So for me, that's what I get from my community, is actively, you know, out there engaging, peacemaking. Because I view that as active, not just a, I believe in peace. What does that actively mean to me? It's actively engaging that in how I speak to people and how I engage the larger society beyond also to as well my community, right? Also to as well why I converted to this Islam is because I love to challenge. I love to learn. And also to as well in this Islam we're supposed to go far and wide to educate ourselves. We're supposed to ask questions. We're not supposed to take something for, if it doesn't feel right to me, I will ask a question. We're not supposed to take something for just because somebody said it, right? And also traditionally, Islam comes without a papacy, without a hierarchy. So this, for me, in the larger context, so much power given to imams or whatnot, or the clergy per se, for me, I'm like, that's not congruent with how Islam is supposed to be. And that's what I believe. So also to dwell in our space, what I really sort of challenge is that Islam is not a monolith. And that's what I really love about that, because for me, your experience is going to be different. Your experience is going to be different. Your life experience is going to be different. Your life experience is going to be different. Therefore, your Islam is your own unique Islam. There is a traditional saying where we say, God is closer to us than our own jugular veins, right? And so for me, I really hold on to that because if God is closer to me to my own jugular vein, then I'm going to, God's always with me. Not that I'm paranoid and like, oh, I can't do anything or I did wrong or whatnot, but also God for me is very forgiving and knows what I'm doing. I'm not hiding anything from God. I might not tell you something or send to my life a little bit on Facebook or whatnot, but God knows what's going on with me. So that's a little bit about my journey to Islam. Do you say anything else? Is that long enough?
Yeah, that's good. Good.
Okay, fabulous. That's me. I'm sure we get to more questions in the Q&As. Thank you very much for coming out. Like I said before, it's really great to be home. It's really great to be bringing some of my work home with me, and this is the first time that I get to actually talk and engage with fellow Nova Scotians, or excuse me, other Nova Scotians that are really interested in this topic, and it's really a blessing for me to be back here. So thank you.
And among so many wonderful and lovely people. I think I'm going to begin by telling you a conversation that I had some while ago. This is a woman that I had known growing up and then lost contact with and then reconnected. And she's a dervish, she's a Sufi. We belong to different Rifai dervish communities. But I get to see her when I go to Vancouver, and she said, one day, why do you use this word queer? Why do you want to make distinctions? So I come to this from a social activist, former political candidate, lawyer, right? All the stereotypes that come up. So I tried to sort of respond to her. And then I went and I sort of thought some more about it. And I emailed her. And I referred to Rumi, to Mevlana, who says, come, whoever you are, right? Wanderer, fire worshiper, idolater. So why does Rumi do that? Why does he say, hey, all, come on in? I think he did that because he understood that there were different ways that different people are treated. So So you've got to call it out. You can't just say, hey, come everybody, because in our context, we'll end up with a bunch of straight cisgendered white men up at the front and everybody else will be at the back. Right? Or in this case, more men up in the front than... So there's an intentionality. So then my mom has a conversation with me. She was visiting us for Ramadan and for Eid. So she raised the same issue. Why the word queer? And I told her, well, I'll tell you what I told her in a second. So Allah moves in mysterious ways. And sometimes Allah moves through social media. This afternoon, literally about 2 hours ago, I'm scrolling through. And this post comes up. Not queer like gay. Queer like escaping definition. Queer like some sort of fluidity. And limitlessness at once. Fluidity and limitlessness. Limitlessness at once. Queer like a freedom too strange to be conquered. Queer like the fearlessness to imagine what love can look like and pursue it. I said to my mother, so hold that, yeah? Like I said, Allah moves in mysterious ways, even through Facebook. Right? So my answer to my mother was, for me, and yes, I mean, people have different definitions. I read something on Facebook where for the writer, you know, being queer was simply about his sexuality and being non-conformist on a number of different levels. And that's fine, that's his understanding. But that's not my understanding. So for me, the notion of queerness is the is the notion of being other, and then taking that other and centralizing it, shifting your paradigms, transforming what the other is into being the mainstream. Because there's more of us than there is of them, whatever us and them means, and does it actually mean anything? So in my work as one of the co-founders, and I take this space as the coordinating imam, and it's a strange space for me to be. When we first started, I didn't want this sort of title of imam, right? But it's really interesting. I just did an interview a few days ago, and this woman, on, you know, when she was screening me, was like, but you are an imam, right? And I kept avoiding the question, right? Because for me to say I am the imam creates a hierarchy that I am not comfortable with, right? Our notion of the Al-Tawheed Jummah circles of our unity mosques is to speak to the notion of Tawheed. In Arab, we chose the name Al-Tawheed Jummah circle because the Jummah is Friday, so that's congregational worship, right? And our visions have been evolving, and even our understanding of the impact of the space and the spaces that we continue to create is evolving. But in Muslim traditions, there is the notion of the halakha, the study circle. And what does halakha mean? Circle, hello. And so we have forgotten this tradition, or we have marginalize this tradition of the study circle, of the halakha. And there's a notion that there is the halakha over there, but then there is the mosque over here on some level, even though halakhas take place usually or often in mosques. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we also wanted to create a space that was intentionally queer. So a lot of our folks are vegan and vegetarian. A lot of them are peaceniks. A lot of folks have been involved in social justice and equity and human rights work and so on and so forth. Right? Because we have forgotten sometimes that there is a spirituality in our activism. Mm-hmm. Right? But the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, was queer because he challenged the society's norms. In a society that was governed by blood and class and caste, he said, no, you are brethren in faith. Gone are the Arab and the African and the black and the white. All believers are one. Mm. And of course, he said this in a patriarchal constructed society. So all men are created equal except black folk, right? And women are, might be free if they're white, but they're not really fully men. Right? So who does that interpretation? So people will say to us, are you trying to create a different kind of Islam, or why are you trying to create a different kind of religion? I'm not trying to create a different kind of religion. I'm trying to go back to the religion that my prophet brought. Mm-hmm. And mind you, who's my prophet? Because Muslims affirm all the prophets from Adam and Eve to Muhammad. Right? So in the Quran mentions about 32, 33 some odd names or individuals. Not everybody is directly named. But the prophetic tradition, the Sunnah, sorry, the Hadith, there are various different references, but the number that has currency is 124,000 prophets to all of humanity through all of time. So not confined to any geographical region or to any ethnicity or any racial group, but universal. So there's a notion of this universal access to the divine. And Allah in the Quran, the story says, pointed out, says, I'm closer to you than your own jugular vein. So how do I understand that? I understand that every single one, that God has the same relationship with every single person, no matter who or what you are. Whether you're Muslim, or whether you are a Christian, or whether you are an atheist, or whether you are a Hindu, God has exactly the same religion, has the same relationship. The difference is what relationship we choose with the divine and what we call him, her, it, whatever we call. So the notion of the ultimate Jummah circle of the Unity Mosque, in Islam we have a notion called Tawheed, often understood to be the unity, the oneness, the supremacy of God. But Tawheed also speaks to interconnections. So there's a unity between our inner and outer selves, between the Creator and the created, between all of creation. It's these things that bind us. We're all interconnected. And so Tawheed is about the unity of message, the unity of humanity. Right? But unity we don't understand to be sameness. Allah in the Quran in chapter 49, 13 says, I created you into different nations and tribes, so that you may know and learn from each other. Mm-hmm. So God enshrines pluralism and diversity as part of God's will and creation. Right? So we started Al-Tawheed Jummah Circle with these kinds of notions, with these kinds of sense of intimacy with the Creator, with a sense of cohesion and unity and interconnectedness and intersectionalities of all of creation and all of humanity. We sit in a circle because that circle is like a wheel. It's constantly turning. And so every person who is a part of our congregation has equal access to the minbar, to the pulpit, to lead prayer, to give the call to prayer, to lead the prayer, or to give the sermon, or to be part of any part of the process of the mosque service. So this comes back to why I'm uncomfortable with the title of imam. Imam simply means leader. But I don't see, I give a sermon, if I can avoid it, only once a month or once in 2 months. I avoid leading prayer because as a cisgendered male, I can go to, take my earrings off and go to a mosque, a traditional mosque, and maybe be able to lead prayer. But my sisters and my trans brethren will never be able to do that. So I tend to pray in the last row. So there's a notion of egalitarianism. There's a notion that we all have something to teach, but that we also all have something to learn. And what we all have something to learn is experience, because Islam is not a monolith, it is not a thing. As Adnan said to me this afternoon, and to me and Troy, you know, you can't take Islam out for lunch. Right? We are Islam. And Islam is not a monolith. At this point in time, and it never has been, and it's not a monolith in time or space or location. It's a living, breathing, or maybe it's not a thing, maybe it's many things. Mm-hmm. And what we understand is today in this location is not necessarily what's being understood somewhere else, or what was understood 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. And so it is dynamic, and it is organic. And the Quran continues to unfold. Allah says in the Quran, I sent Muhammad as a mercy to the worlds. Our world was not frozen in 7th century Arabia. If Islam is frozen in time and space, then it is a dead thing. Because it cannot respond. But again, it's not a thing. We make it a monolith. We make it a thing. Right? So in we don't impose gender segregation or a dress code. Allah in the Quran enjoins modesty on all believers. So if you think that we have house etiquette, so if you think that somebody is not modestly dressed, Allah in the Quran says, lower your gaze. Keep lowering it till you find modesty. So part of the challenge, so the topic, my topic was, how long have I been ranting for?
We're enjoying it.
Okay.
So,
can I go on for a couple of minutes? Yeah?
I like the rant.
Okay.
Keep it up.
I lost myself.
Enjoys modesty?
Okay. People sometimes also have a concern around the fact that we don't gender segregate. You're free to stand wherever you want, with wherever you want. Mecca and Medina, the Saudis in the last 25 years have changed Medina. It is now gender segregated in the Prophet's Mosque. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mecca is not segregated yet. The Saudis are working on it. But there are narratives of the Prophet Muhammad and his wife Khadija and his cousin Ali praying side by side in Mecca for years. For years it was just the three of them. Islam was one man. First Muslim was a woman. And the second Muslim was what we would consider a child because he was, I think, 13 years old. Nine? So this is why it's important that we have a rotating imamah. Because I don't claim to know everything. I just know what I know. And I'm constantly learning, and I'm constantly reevaluating, and I'm fortunately constantly being challenged. Mm-hmm. But part of the challenge is people who want to make you the imam. And I was brought up my parents always taught me that there was no clergy in Islam, especially not in Sunni tradition Islam. And even, in Shia Islam, arguably the so-called clergy is just a way and a vehicle to knowledge. And not because at the end of each sermon we say, and Allah knows best. Which means they could be wrong, but they don't mean it. They'll say, and Allah knows best, but I know what Allah knows. So for us, this notion of every person in the congregation being able to give the sermon means that that layers of the Quran are constantly being revealed and re-revealed to me from a different perspective. And it might be ahistorical, but that's all right. Because Allah is closer to you than your own chapter. Now the issue sometimes comes up around sort of queerness, about LGBTIQ people. There's a whole bunch of new theology that's going on in new explorations. In terms of, so we have the story of the people of Lot, which Christian and Jewish folk may understand as Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities are not named, they're called the cities of the plains. Okay, but it's the same folk. And so just as our Jewish and our Christian beloveds have explored and looked at and worked on reinterpreting these or revisiting our understanding, maybe is a better way of putting it, revisiting our understanding as the world gets unfolded to us by science, which continues to glorify and expound and enlighten and illuminate God's creation around us. That's how I see science, not as an opposition to faith or to spirituality. So too must our understanding of how we read and understand the Quran also continue to grow and to be illuminated. So a lot of people want to come to me and say, tell me the answer to this. What should I believe? And I can't do that. And I won't do that. I can tell you what I believe, and I can tell you why I believe it. But I can't tell you that's what you should believe. But if it makes sense to you, or if some part of it makes sense to you, if it resonates with you, excuse me, take it and make it your own. Right? And sometimes learning is easy, but unlearning is really difficult. And the hardest thing to do is to unlearn. And patriarchy is really, really hard to unlearn. Because it is so vested, so insipid, and so pervasive. Allah is closer to you than your own jugular vein. The veils that we put, the veils that the world puts, are the veils that we are trying to take apart. It's what separates us from each other, from true Tawheed, the unity of all of creation. It's all part of a master plan. We're all part of each other. And each other is all part of us. So the challenge in also in being an imam, the imam, a coordinating imam, is also the crisis of authenticity. So I'm really thankful for being here in this space. Because this is also a faith tradition that is also questioning and challenging, especially with its current papacy. And I appreciate that. Right? Because one of the things that Troy and I have experienced in Toronto, I'm doing my master's in chaplaincy at Emmanuel College, which is a United Church college. But sometimes I find that the so-called progressive churches don't want to deal with us. Because they want to have a relationship with the quote-unquote mainstream Muslim community. The ones that will not accept their women and gay priests. But they want to have a relationship with them and kind of sideline us. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, who supported you when you all were starting up your churches? Bad allyship. We don't need that. Thanks, brother. Thanks. Mm-hmm. But that's a challenge of being in a, I'll say, in a leadership capacity in the creation of this sacred space. So our space is open to everybody, Muslim, non-Muslim, however you define yourself, believer, non-believer, doesn't matter. You're all welcome. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, said, humanity is like the teeth of a comb. And you are not a true believer till you love for your neighbor what you love for yourself. What do you love for yourself? Look around you. Look to your right, look to your left. Allah in the Quran says, whether you turn to the east or the west, it doesn't matter. Everywhere you turn is the face of God. Look again. Look to your right. Look to your left. See the face of God. Thank you. I was thinking the same thing, which is why I wanted to go before you. So.
I am Sayed Adnan Hussain. I am a professor at St. Mary's University. I teach primarily in Islamic studies. I'm most interested in Islam in sort of the modern period. And I have to say that I struggled for many years with my Islam and how I was going to approach Islam, because when we first came to the United States as a family, we went to our local mosque, and my father walked us out of there, and he said, we're not going back. That space is not the kind of space that we grew up with, that we had. My family was filled with Hindus, it was filled with Marxists, it was filled with atheists, it had Jews, it had blacks, it had whites. And so as a result, our Islam had to be tolerant of all of these identities sitting down to dinner. And if it wasn't, then fundamentally something was very wrong with the way that this family was operating and running. And that's not necessarily the exception in where I'm from, and from South Asia. That's actually quite frequently the rule, is the fact that these households, these families are deeply, deeply complicated. And hating one or another Muslim group, if I was a Shia, they were telling me the Sunnis are out to get you. If you're a Sunni, you're saying the Shias are up to something over here. I that didn't fully make sense to me, and the only way it made sense was when people were making jokes about it at the dinner table. So when people were saying, oh God, it's Muharram, the Shias are going to be crying and beating themselves. Or alternatively, if it was a particular kind of Eid, the Sunnis would be arguing over when Eid begins or when it doesn't begin. And so there was just this kind of conflict that people would reduce to familial banter. And that, so that's the way that I had dealt with interreligious issues within, and also conflict within Islam. And so for me, both as a person who was kind of dealing with my own sexual identity issues, dealing with my own politics, kind of understanding myself and my place, I couldn't fit in these mosques, and they weren't open to me. And then when I started attending El Farouk and Troy's mosque in Toronto, while I was a graduate student there, it was really transformative. I felt a sense of home that I had never felt before, and so that was quite different. And then the other problem I was having is, as an academic working on my PhD in Islamic studies, I had to deal with the fact that the Islam which I was now practicing on Fridays had no place in the Islam that I was teaching on the other days of the week. So what was I going to do about that? One of the problems is academics, or as academics, we're pushed very hard to talk about Islam like a thing, right? Like a thing that makes sense. That a thing that has particular rules, a particular way, a particular style of functioning, and nearly all Muslims should agree about the ways that this stuff works. So all of the kind of textbooks that you have for introduction to Islam classes are insipid with this kind of stuff, that Islam is a thing and it makes perfect sense and has these particular rules and it functions in this particular way. And I had never encountered that Islam. It wasn't the Islam of my family. It wasn't the Islam of my faith community that I was attending on Fridays. It certainly wasn't the Islam of the poetry that I was reading in the past. Let me give you an example. This is again from Rumi. This is just a description of an interaction between a student and his master, and they're both men. And he's saying, when someone quotes the old poetic image about clouds uncovering the moon, slowly loosen each string by string your robe and say, it's like this. And then he pushes further. He says, if anyone asks how Jesus raised the dead, don't exclaim, but kiss me on the lips and say, like this. Now it kind of pushes those boundaries, right? Like, this is definitely homoerotic. And it's the erotics of it that make me think that, what is going on with queer identities in Muslim context? How, if we assume that people have had different sexual orientations because of a fact of biology for time immemorial, how have Muslim queers been accommodated, accepted, and dealt with in the past historically? And did they participate in setting up the kind of structures of the law that then are now being used to brutalize them? And so when I was uncovering this kind of stuff, I found academics like, if you have an interest in this subject matter, Scott Siraj Al-Haq Kugel, he's a professor at Emory University. He has a book called Islam, Homosexuality in Islam, and it is an exquisite text. And he challenges Muslims on multiple levels. He challenges their approach to the Quran. He challenges, as an insider, he's also challenging their approach to fiqh, which is Islamic, which is really the term that should be used for Islamic law. He challenges us to think about the ways that the prophetic traditions have been used as a tool of oppression against marginalized people. And that's something that we have to be intensely focused on, is this question of justice. Because I find secularism, for me at least as a person, doesn't offer me the language of justice. Secularism is about outcomes, right? That's what the court system is kind of about. It's about resulting in outcomes, and justice is process. Did you get your day in court? Did you have an opportunity to speak to your lawyer, is the kind of questions we ask in our justice system. But that's not about justice, that's about process. And so the language of justice for me needed to be religiously charged. It was about the bigger things, it was about the connections between us, and about how we could then perhaps stand against injustice. So I needed an Islam which would stand with the indigenous communities in this space on Turtle Island, an Islam that would work together in solidarity with people who aren't just like me. But very frequently, one of the other dangers, as we've been discussing dangers with this issue as well, is queer Muslims, people try to weaponize us and to use us as a tool against other Muslims who don't agree with us. So for example, they'll say, we have these good liberal Muslims over here, why can't you be more like them? right? They'll go ask mosque communities and sort of antagonize them in that particular fashion. And we're very sensitive to that because I don't want my identity, my politics, and my work to be used to harm other people. Even if they don't necessarily agree with my politics and they may not like me very much as a result of it. It's this desire to uphold the plurality of Islam, the idea that it needs to be multivalent, it needs to operate in a complicated fashion. It can't be normative. It can't be one thing. There is no one Islam. And so when I now teach at the university, the kind of ways that I challenge this is what I'm calling increasingly queering Islam. Is first off, how can we have statements like there is wine, consumption of wine is forbidden in Islam, but yet all of Sufi poetry is soaked in wine? Right? And then moreover, what if we were to say wine is prohibited in Islam, but one of the items of state, which would be the coins which they would stamp the emperor's figure on, has Emperor Jahangir holding a wine cup, saying he is the defender of Islam underneath him in Persia. Does that make sense? Like, how does that make sense? How do Muslims understand that from those contexts and those different times? And I think that there's a tendency now to assume that if you aren't following the law, or if you're not obsessing over what is haram and halal, that you're not necessarily a good Muslim. That rather, you're sort of a Muslim that doesn't understand what's really important, as opposed to the way that a lot of Muslims have come to Islam is through love. And in some cases, especially for Sufis, there's this understanding that they belong to this, and this it's a term used by, I think, Shabir Ahmed, at any rate, he calls it in his book recently, What is Islam? He says this thing is called the Madhab-e-Ishq. Mm. And what that literally means is the school or the way of love. And that's a way that some Muslims kind of practice their Islam as well, is a love and a respect for the dignity of the other people that you encounter and you interact with, a respect for the fact that they have engaged the tradition in their own way and they've come up with their own conclusions that don't necessarily agree with mine. And making that space and opening that space for these kind of conversations. Which is why I kind of called this talk in some ways Queering Islam Starting Conversations. The idea is that you aren't necessarily just here as people listening and absorbing information. I would like you to also engage with us and challenge us and help us queer Islam. Make it a little bit different, make it a little bit strange, which is the other side of queer, right? Is to make something a bit strange and work out those understandings of Islam that are Muslims are terrorists, Muslims are operate in this particular way, all Muslims hate Muslim women, or something, or these obscene kind of statements that you'll hear in the press. And what you'll start seeing is that Islam has always been something of a queer thing. That on the one hand, you've got the legalisms of a particular kind of Islam, and then on the other hand, you've got the everyday lived experience of Muslims, which are going to look very different, but yet there has always been a respect for this individual struggle to find God, to kind of negotiate your relationship with the divine and the infinite, and understand and appreciate concepts such as justice. So what I'm calling a queering of Islam is both finding these queer things, like this poetry, in Islam, and these identities that don't fully make sense if we assume this Orientalist heteronormative narrative of how Muslims are in the world, but also more importantly, queering Islam is inviting others to participate and help us learn and help us appreciate the kind of struggles that we're going to face as communities in the future, as opposed to the parochialism of saying, I am a German, or I am a Canadian, or I am from the United States. We're going to deal with problems that invoke all of us as human beings. We're sort of tearing our planet apart. And if we don't have a theology or a worldview that is going to be able to help us deal with the fact of this intense difference that has to come together, to struggle together, I worry about us as a people. And so now when I teach, I find that I try to teach, every week I try to destabilize what my students have understood about Islam in the last week. Some of them are quite unhappy. Some of them have ended a little bit unhappy. But on the one hand, I'll teach, for example, one week about how the conversation on homosexuality, for example, will be drawn on the Quran, the story of Lot. But then I ask them, sort of I push them a little bit for a queer interpretation. So if you're saying on the one hand that the story of Lot is about homosexual or male-on-male rape, then does that make us think differently of the story? Is the Quran forbidding sexual intercourse, or is it forbidding rape? Rape would make sense if it's forbidding that. Or alternatively, if you were to rank the crimes the way that the Quran understands it, rejecting the Prophet is much higher on the list of bad things you could do than engaging in consensual homosexual sexuality. And so rejecting the Prophet is very high. So if the people of Lot were destroyed, was it for rejecting the Prophet, or was it for engaging in homosexual acts? Maybe more importantly, why were the women and children of Lot killed if their men were interested in raping some visitors who came to the city? Like, how is that justice in that, if the women and children are being killed? The crime would probably have to be other people. Something would have to be very wrong. And the tendency has been, because of an aggressive and oppressive patriarchy, has been that it needs to be interpreted to serve a particular agenda and a particular understanding of masculinity, homonormativity. And that kind of stuff, when we reread the tradition with different lenses on, kind of erasing our understandings of Victorian masculinity that sort of kicked the dandies out and everyone else, I think we get a much more robust understanding of the ways that history can teach us and the ways that we don't have to settle for history as a dead thing. It can kind of inform the ways that we engage with the present and we can move forward in the future. So I hope to inspire my students in that way. And I hope they leave my class, and if someone asks them what is Islam, I sincerely hope they don't have a simple answer.
Usually when I get up in situations like this and find myself having to speak, I just say a little prayer that God will give me the words that I need, because I find myself in situations like this, not quite like this, but in situations of explaining myself and my faith a fair amount. I think, oh my God, there can be a thumbs up. So. Thanks, sweetheart, that helps. So I'm a public school teacher. I teach in Bridgetown, I teach at Bridgetown High School. I'm imagining most people here are Halifax folk or city folk. So if you think of where Annapolis Royal is, just before that, and there are under 400 kids in my school from grade 6 through 12. So when I say a small school, we are a small school. Mm-hmm. I don't actually know everybody by name, but I certainly would recognize most faces, and I would say all the students would recognize me. You know, they see me out in public anyway, so I know them. They know me. We have a kind of a personal relationship. And of course, being at this school, recently this past year, we now have 4 students from Iraq in our school, so I'm no longer actually the only Muslim within whatever kind of a radius it was. But for a long time, it was me. And barring Fox News and social media and whatnot, I was the only Muslim that my students had met. And I was probably going to be the only Muslim that they would meet for goodness knows how long. For those who leave Bridgetown, maybe forever. For those who do leave Bridgetown, which is most of them wanting to get out, they will eventually small town Nova Scotia. What do you do for a living? I guess you're moving to Hortons. So they mostly want to leave. They mostly have a goal of getting out of Halifax, further afield, whatever it happens to be. So they will encounter other Muslims in their lives, inshallah. But until then, I'm in from like grade 6 to 12. So, you know, that's it's kind of a big responsibility. And I find myself being up in front of my students. I mostly teach social studies, so we're talking about history. So there's another huge responsibility, representing a position that I really didn't think through when I went into teaching. I've wanted to be a teacher since I was my daughter's age, she's 9. And I wasn't thinking, when I became a Muslim, I wasn't thinking through the implications of what it would mean to teach in a rural school, presenting as visibly Muslim and being more or less against my will a spokesperson. I should also say at this point that most teachers in Nova Scotia, barring the Muslim part, are just like me. They are white, straight, cisgendered women. you look at any public school in Nova Scotia, I'm like, hi, I'm your teacher, all across the various school boards. For the most part, Halifax, I get the sense, is a little different, but certainly the Annapolis Valley where I am your teacher everywhere you go. The Muslim thing is a little different, but other than that, you know, it's pretty standard. So I'm also Miss Gold's GSA facilitator, and I use the word facilitator very deliberately. I really don't want to say I'm a GSA leader. I'll sometimes say advisor, but I prefer facilitator, because to me that means I open my classroom, and at the beginning of the year I put up some posters saying what this is, and then the students come in, and they run it. As much as possible, they run it. I'm kind of their liaison with the admin for like, hey, you guys want to have an assembly, so I guess I'm phoning the people who are going to come and speak. But they come up with the ideas, and as much as possible, they make it happen. This past year, I had the youngest GSA I've ever had. They were all in grade 7 and 8. So it's been a while for most of us. That means they were like 12, 13, 14 years old, all of them. They're kids. Like, they're not even teenagers, except technically. They're little kids still in many ways. And they're this teeny little group, there are about 12 of them, and it's a very big school. Being the ones to put this message out there of open-mindedness, of diversity, of tolerance, of acceptance, all the things they're trying to do. Facing homophobia, facing all the pressures of middle level. You guys remember grade 7, right?
Vaguely.
It improves a bit by grade 10, but grade 7, 8, 9, those are the terrible years. In many ways, with your teachers too. But certainly, okay, you guys are much better as an audience in my class. Are and what you want to be and how you want to present yourselves and you know what hairstyle you want, all these crucial things. And maybe you're also queer, and so you're trying to navigate that in a rural high school where you know everybody in town, you grew up with all these people, and you just can't wait to get out. And so for me, I feel like I have this enormous responsibility to be there as the GSA facilitator. And one of the things I really try to make a point of saying, because my students don't always get this. It sort of goes a couple ways. They've either been raised, for the most part, in a Christian tradition that they either love. I have quite a few like youth group volunteers in my GSA, which was, I have to say, a surprise to me. I hadn't expected that, so that was a learning experience for me. Or, for the most part, they've been raised in a tradition that they don't feel welcomes and supports them, and again, usually a Christian tradition. They really, really wanted it first to make me be like, good person, not for my religion. You know, they wanted to be able to sit around and bash religion and bash faith. And then when I was like, hello? Oh, Sam, you're different, though. Okay, now I'm going to have to explain to you that if you go up to pretty much any mosque in North America, you're probably not going to get the reception that you might think you might get based on what I'm saying to you. And so there's that. There's sort of, you know, navigating that with them. But then there's also me being very careful to be like, don't set me up as the good Muslim who gets it. Because you need to understand, I don't want you to recopy that whole narrative of, you know, as you were saying, that like, you know, the good religious people are the good people, and the bad people are the bad religious people over here, and we have this dichotomy, and we just have these little battles where we fight each other. I don't want my students to think that that's the way it is either. I don't want them to think that everybody but their Christian community is going to accept them, like every other religion will be fine with them, because that's going to hurt them if they think that's the case. But I also don't want them to think that I'm this shining exception, and that every other Muslim is going to be able to get them, because that's really damaging too. And it flattens the differences in our community, it flattens the differences in our world. And so I don't want them to think that either. So it's a weird experience. I'm up there in front of these kids, and I feel like, wow, you know, I've got to mentor you through the GSA and help you with that while still giving you the autonomy to learn and make your mistakes on your own. And I want to show you that faith can be a welcoming space for you through my own personal example and my experiences, knowing that however my experiences and the experiences of somebody who's straight and cisgendered. But then I don't want you to think that I'm this great example who's exceptional, because then that's really not fair to all the other people who are working for justice and change and who are just basically decent, open-minded people. And I feel like I'm standing there going, I didn't expect to be in this position. And it's been very interesting for me. So, I have to say, I didn't have much of a prepared speech here, so I'm kind of just half looking at my notes and half trying to explain what it feels like to be me up in front of a class of 25-odd kids. And I think the biggest thing with being a teacher, even aside from being a Muslim teacher or being an ally, which I hope that I am, or being GSA facilitator, is that ideally if you're a teacher, the big thing that you do is you decenter yourself. And here I am up giving you a speech, which is not the way I like to do it. But I think the most important thing, and I really hope education is changing this way, is that if you're teaching, if you have this enormous blessing and responsibility of being up in front of a group of young people and speaking to them, they're supposed to be listening, is that you have to take yourself out of the role where you are the giver of all knowledge to them. And so I really try as a teacher to make it about the knowledge that they can bring into the room and that they can share it with me. And I really love being able to say to my kids, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. And let you get your smartphone out now, look that up for me. They love it when I say that. Yeah, well, look this up for me. You have the tools now to not just accept everything I passively say and just sit there like good little automatons taking it in and writing notes. You can challenge me. Please do it politely. But you can challenge me as, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, whatever you happen to be, and you can talk back. And for me, that's what I found in my faith as well. I feel like, as a Muslim, I don't have to sit and accept what I'm told. I feel like I can go and look for the answers myself, and I can interpret things on my own, and I can turn to other people who I trust and respect, and get their opinion. And we might not agree. Or I might think they're really awesome and like be copying down everything they say. I get why they get him to give me an omelet, right? but it comes down to me and my decision and whether or not I'm going to take that in and accept that and make that part of who I am as a Muslim, or whether I'm going to say, no, that's not for me. And I'd like to see my students doing the same thing. You know, I'm up here teaching them Canadian history. That's a fun subject, by the way, because that can be incredibly whitewashed or really not. And it's a great subject for trying to disrupt these narratives of power and patriarchy that we have, if you want to teach it that way. But I can be up there teaching this, and I have the outcomes that I'm sort of following along through with the projects that we're doing and the deadlines. And honestly, ideally, the best possible scenario is a student puts their hand up and says, hang on a sec, or well, I thought, and they just wrench the class in a whole other direction, and all of a sudden we're learning something that we never saw coming. And sometimes it's a little out there, we kind of have to pull back to what we were doing, and sometimes it's great and we just go with that. And I feel like that's what critical pedagogy really ought to be. I feel like that's what teaching at its base ought to be. It's not me giving you the information, it's your information and sharing your information with each other. And I'm starting to allow that technology maybe plays a role in that, slowly allowing that. But it can be a great tool for decentering power structure in the room. Looking at my notes here. So I try to do with the GSA as well. Again, sort of like I'm not the GSA authority. That's not my lived experience. I'm just the grown up who can unlock the classroom door and put the desk in a circle. You know, if it's coming from me, there's a problem. Really, if that's happened, that's a huge problem. If I'm saying, okay, guys, hey, post your campaign, that's a problem. If I'm always the one pushing this, because it's theirs, it should be theirs. And I feel like I can guide it. You know, I kind of want to do as the GSA advisor what you want to do as the imam. I want to, you know,
exactly.
Facilitate, move things along.
I'm taking
like,
notes, oh. Yeah.
You know, like, really need to put those posters up, and we're not going to get you members, but it has to come from them in the end. It really does. And so both as a teacher, conventional teacher, as a Muslim in my religious community, as a GSA facilitator, all these are, as a member of my family, heck, my goal as a person in these spaces is to not make myself the authority any more than I absolutely have to, because, you know, at the end of the day, we do have bells and fairly rigid class schedules and outcomes that I have to hit. But as much as possible, to try to interrupt that stuff and give the power back to the people who are really involved in it. And I can give it back to them. They have it. But to remind them that they have it, and to remind myself that I don't have it and that I shouldn't be trying to take it. How much more I really have to say, except that this is my daughter over here. Stand up for me. My daughter Sophia.
Hey, Sophia.
I want to point her out that she's in grade 4. She's going to grade 4 this year. She just said she's going to start trying to maybe wear hijab more often, which is cool. That's her decision. I totally understand why you might not want to some of these summer days, in fact, but I get it, please. But she wants to join her school's GSA. She's a little young for it. She was told that she's not quite old enough for it, which I don't think is fair. But, you know, she's going to challenge that. But my hope for her, you know, she challenges me a lot. And sometimes it drives me crazy. But my hope, and the reason I do this GSA stuff in the first place, and really the reason I became a teacher in the first place, and it sounds so cliche to say it, but young people like that, you know, it's not that they're the only future, because we all have a hand in the future, but the world that they're going to move into after we're adults are dead and gone, like, we can't even imagine what that's going to look like. I can't imagine what her world is going to look like. You know, when she, 9-year-old now, when she's in her 80s, and she's got her great-grandkids, inshallah, right? You know, what is that world going to be? And if I want that world to be something that would be worth inheriting, then I have no excuse to sit on my white, straight, cisgendered butt and do nothing to bring it about. I don't think that.
Distinguishing there. Thank
you.
But just one thing that's a little bit important to state is that think of this as a safe space to vet any concerns or questions that you've been kind of kicking around in your mind. The most common one we tend to get, like even we did a short interview today for the CBC, and the CBC keeps wanting to set us up a little bit as fighting other Muslims. I'm not convinced I'm a pugilist of any sort, so I'm not interested in that. But also, the other thing that's important is that people aren't invited to ask difficult questions because they're worried maybe about the way they'll look or the way that it'll represent. And right, and that's the kind of stuff that you're hearing a lot in the Trump election, right? That he asks the tough questions and gives the stupid answers. But it's more that if you have a question such as, like, have there been homosexuals in Islam or in Islamic contexts? Please, it's not an ignorant question. It's rather a question seeking an answer. And we would be happy to offer whatever we have.
Or not.
Or not. Or
what about to answer that question?
Well, I mean... okay.
That was a setup, eh?
All right.
Yeah.
I'll give a snippet and then I'll pass it around. But the part that's important about that is that we can't confuse what is taking place mostly in the modern West as something that has taken place historically always. So today, sexual identity being asserted as a political identity is something very different than anything that we've encountered in that same fashion in the past. Which is not to say that queer bodies haven't existed in the past. It's rather that the politics in the way that it's manifesting today has not existed in the past. And sometimes I think people want to be very intentionally ungenerous towards certain people. Like when Ahmadinejad was once asked about Iran, he said, there's no homosexuals there.
But perhaps also what he was saying is that there's no homosexual identity as it is constructed in the places that you are from and the places that I am from. Because Iran is doing something, is engaging in a very strange social experiment when it comes to homosexuality. One of the things that they're doing is they're saying that gay men can be together as long as one of them has a surgery to become a woman. So that their body matches the soul that they have, and Iran ends up being one of the places with the most sexual reassignment surgeries. So that's kind of a shocking
thing.
Paid for by the state. So, but I mean, of course, that's forcing a certain kind of conformity on people who may not be wanting it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the conversation looks different over there than it does over here about this kind of issue. And highlighting that stuff is important, but also in terms, historically, we've had caliphs who were known who had sexual access to their male slaves and enjoyed it. We know that there are poets who've discussed it at length. Same-sex desire, we know that it was manifesting, especially in legal cases. That's the one that it comes up a lot. One of the things is in Islamic law, you can't really be tried for adultery unless there's...
Islamic law, generally, the rule was that you can't be tried for adultery unless four male witnesses came in front. So you would not only have to be having sex with someone else, but having sex with an audience. So if I was to have sex right now...
That's willing to testify against.
Then, yeah. So the rule that it sets up creates a considerable gray zone, right, for praxis or practice. Now, it may have been the case that Muslim homosexuals in the past may have been still required to marry, but would have had their encounters elsewhere. In fact, there's a whole structure of law about whether or not you can have sex with your male slave and whether or not that male slave can then penetrate you, because that's the real crime. And it's all like Islamic law is obsessed with penetration. That's why when women are engaging in it, in tribadism, they don't know what to do with the law. It just creates a very confusing space. They're not really sure what to deal with. And also, Islamic law in its traditional classical fashion is about classism. So a male slave penetrating his owner is a problem for the law, more so than whether or not it's same-sex desire and same-sex exercise taking place. It's who is doing it is what they're super concerned about.
Who's doing it and who's doing it to who.
And who's doing it to whom. Mm. And so that stuff in the law doesn't exist unless there's a conversation taking place about it. Right? Those are the artifacts that highlight the fact that this stuff is taking place. In addition, as Al-Farouk mentioned this afternoon when we were talking, the hijra identity, the identity of the third gender, has existed in South Asia for a millennia or more, a very long time, in fact. And those identities were accepted by a conservative Muslim nation like Pakistan. You can have your the third gender entered, or gender X entered on your national identity card, on your Shinakhti card, before anyone here in the West had done it. So that these kind of ideas of what is Muslim and what isn't Muslim, I'm always trying to kind of put that through the mill. I'm considered something of a dangerous person in my family. People don't like to talk to me because I'm armed with a job that encourages me to research the stuff that they're ignorant about. So, but I like being a troublemaker. My teacher Abdullahi An-Naim in Atlanta told me you should be a heretic. You should always strive to be a heretic. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? Because every orthodoxy has to begin as a heresy. So at least you can begin, start as a heretic now, and you can work your way up.
You know, I was taking my notes too, and one of the things that I really liked, to paraphrase, if your answers are coming from me, we've got a problem. I really like that. I had a quote that I was going to read to you, and just something to add on in terms of the pluralism of our spaces. Our Unity Mosques welcome, like I said, all kinds of people, even people who are not Muslim identified, but also what's particularly, I think, relevant is the fact that we also have different kinds of Muslims. So we have Shia and Sunni from a variety of different traditions, people who identify as Muslim but not by denomination, like Troy and myself and my mother, And other folks who are just Muslim, we're not Shia, maybe we're sushi sometimes, right? or as he will say, shiny, because he doesn't like the notion of being...
But
there is a tradition, and you know, when we are talking about the notion of are there examples of non-conforming, of queer, gender non-conforming, or sexual minority people... In Muslim history, it actually goes back to the Mukhannat, who are actually named in Hadith and Sunnah traditions as effeminate men, including Mukhannat, who were in the household of the Prophet, who had equal access to male and female space. Now, this is what our own prejudices do. There's a narrative about one of these Mukhannat in the household of the Prophet who was actually hooking people up. And this got discovered, and so he got chucked out, or they got chucked out. Right? So the naysayers say, oh, they got chucked out because they're Mukhannat. They didn't get chucked out because they're Mukhannat. They got chucked out because they were doing stuff that was considered unsavory in the tradition. Right? There's a one tradition that I want to share with you, and this was quoted by one of the... in our efforts, in our continuing journey to make the minbar, the pulpit, accessible to everybody, in Toronto, our Friday service is accessible by Skype. And people can also give sermons via Skype. And so Saliha DeVoe is an African-American Shia Muslim woman who Skypes in from the United States. And she gave a sermon a while ago that was particularly moving because she dealt with this issue of queerness. And so this is what she started talking about, being alienated. And she said religion had become, the same religion that had given her so much comfort began to become toxic for her because of the patriarchy and the xenophobia and the misogyny. I talked about our prayer space being non-gendered, right? And Muslims have this big thing about bid'ah, innovation, right? But Islam didn't destroy and didn't wipe away what it encountered. It engaged it and it made it and it brought it in. So when I'm in Indonesia and I'm looking at this Hindu temple that was actually completed by people who had converted to Islam, by the time it was finished, but they still completed it in honor of their histories and their families. And there were no Hindus left to worship in that space because they had all come into Islam, but their Islam embraced those traditions and didn't sort of marginalize them. And so Saliha in her khutbah, in her sermon says, speaking of the Unity Mosque, says, this is a space for the Ghuraba, the strangers. Sahih Muslim, the Sunni Hadith collection, contains one of my favorite hadith or reported traditions. Now, she uses this tradition from, quotes this tradition from Abu Huraira. And Abu Huraira is arguably somebody queer or non-conforming. Bit of a misogynist too, because a lot of the anti-woman traditions are narrated by him. But his name literally means the father of kittens. Right, because he adopted kittens. And he actually had dispensation from marriage from the Prophet, because he went to the Prophet and said, I'm not into women. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically the... And so after this sort of conversation with the Prophet gives him dispensation from marriage to a woman. Okay, but Abu Huraira, the father of kittens... Oh goodness, here we go. The father of kittens is reported to have narrated that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, and his Ahle Bayt, his family, blessed family, said, Islam began as something strange, something gharib, and it will return to being strange, so blessed are the Ghuraba, the strangers. And she ended her sermon by saying, God bless the gharib, the strange, the queer. Just coming back to... You can clap later. Gotta come back to the notion of sort of innovation and gendered space, right? So a lot of Muslims are sort of really uptight about the notion of this innovation. And yet the Prophet's mosque had no partition and no barriers. And yet 90% of North American mosques have side entrances for women, if they have entrances for women. And they have partitions in the mosque and mezzanines and walls that separate the women and the men. And is that not bid'ah? Is that not innovation? And what a horrible innovation that you cage up more than 50% of the community, often in spaces where they have improper sight lines, if any sight lines at all, and often little or no audio, and that women and children, because of course that's where the kids will go, have less space in the mosque, if they have space, than the men do. And so if Islam is about justice, tell me, where's the justice there? So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you.
Something else. You can move something else.
I don't know if I can stand up. I have a three-year-old on my lap. I have been very blessed in the Muslim community that I typically participate in Wolfville, because we have a small room. The whole room is way less big than this basement area here. And so there couldn't be a barrier. There is no barrier, because where would they put it? It's a basement room at Acadia University that we have because one of the men in the Muslim community is a professor at Acadia. So I have felt very blessed when I go there, because my kids run around the way they do here, and they act, can you maybe go take this to Daddy, please, kiddo? You go bring this book to Daddy, okay? He needs it. He really needs it. They do what they're doing tonight. And, you know, they disrupt the khutbah. They climb on usually their dad's back when he's praying. And I felt accepted. But there was an experience that I had that I'm sure is common for a lot of us, where I went to a mosque in Toronto, and I don't remember exactly where. You know what I'm about to say. And when we finally found the women's entrance around the side of the building and went down to the dingy basement with the exposed pipes and the bad loudspeaker, what is this teaching my kids? Never mind what it's teaching me. You know, I'm an adult. I can handle it. What's it teaching my kids about their faith? You know, is that going to make them love their faith or want to stay in their faith or feel positive about it? If that was the experience they had every single Friday, I think they'd have to be pretty strong, you know, or maybe I'd have to be really exceptional as a parent to draw the positivity out of that experience. Mm-hmm. I have to say it hasn't been my experience at all. Like, as a transgendered person, would you even be welcomed at all? You know, like, could you, I guess if nobody figured it out, but that would be awful too, because you'd be hiding that whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, we need to step that up a little bit and make that more welcoming, because I think the potential is more than there. But, yeah, you know, and again, I've had some great experiences, I've had some wonderful experiences. I certainly don't want to say that all mosques in Canada or the world have problems like that, but enough of them do. Honestly, even if one of them did, that would be a problem,
yeah.
And that would be something we'd have to work on. So what is it, 90% you said?
Yep.
I will not bring my kids to a space like that. I flat out refuse. I'll walk out. You know, and if I have to walk out in the middle of khutbah and have everybody see me walk out, fine, I'll walk out. So
right.
I don't want to have to do that, though.
Could you stand up if you're able to, please?
Take care of the children and the food and all that. So, if
I'll take that. So really not the topic of this conversation, right? Polygamy is not legal in Canada. So you cannot be legally married to more than one person at a time. That doesn't mean that people don't enter into, in the Muslim community, I know men who are married to more than one woman through just a Muslim ritual. And of course, other people engage in various kinds of relationships, polygamous, polyamorous, as the case may be. Not really our topic, so I'm going to ask that we move on from here to some of the more sort of questions relevant to the notion of queering Islam. No, polygamy is really not my issue. Gender justice, human rights, dignity, how people negotiate their personal relationships in a country where polygamy is by law criminalized is not my issue. And I think we should move on. But thank you for your question.
I'll add something to that, though.
Right, but it's the legal position. You asked me, what's the legal position? The legal position is criminalized. Bas halas.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I'll add something to that, though, because if anyone was reading the court cases or the literature that was coming out of the Supreme Court when they made the decision in the United States to allow for gay marriage, is the way that they were framing it. One of the problems was that the justices on the court set it up to be that we can accept gays who want to get married because they're just the same as heterosexuals that want to get married, because they want to create monogamous households where they can then perpetuate a particular style of heteronormativity, but with men or women together as opposed to one man, one woman together. And one of the problems was that people in the thinkers in the queer community and activists in the queer community started saying, well, does this make a lot of sense? Does this make a lot of sense to give us the same rights that of something we may not necessarily even want? Do we want to participate in marriage? An institution which has been beggared from the translation from sacrament into a contract, at least in Christendom. So this question of giving everyone else the same rights one raises the issue of polygamy a little bit, and this is where I'm kind of bringing it in, is that if the state is in the business of validating relationships between two people, why does it necessarily have to be involved in validating the relationships between only men and women, or men and men, and women and women? Mm-hmm. Why not allow for polyamorous households, polygamous households, as long as it was done under color of law? The advantage of that is you drag more nefarious relationships, which may have been manufactured under this soft Muslim law stuff, out into the open. You allow it to be engaged in public scrutiny. You protect the women who may have been encouraged to enter into those relationships by giving them color of law and a forum to then debate that in front of the public. But that's more from a theoretical perspective, mm-hmm. which is what I read that case decision as in the United States was a principled defense of monogamy. And for a number of us, that's not necessarily the way we understand relationships. So, there we go.
There's a question for women in the back. Thank you. I have a question about the roots.
That's what lewdness, but what would happen was
Between the 7th and 9th century in particular, when Islamic thought was dominated by male scholars in particular, their ways of interpreting these passages were often used to defend ways that their co-religionists, such as Jews, had interpreted these scriptures in the past. And so there was a tendency to take the normative values of other communities and just plop them right out in Islam instead of interrogating them to see how they translate into Islam. So in the case of Lut, this is a particular problem. The other thing about lust and approaching men in lust, generally, the way that even the scholars conceptualize relationships between married couples is that sex should not necessarily be the result of lust. It should be the result of love. That's something quite different. Lust in and of itself is a problem in Islamic law. So let's isolate it. Let's focus very intently on what the text actually says. So if it says that it has a problem with lust, why then should we translate lust into being everything else that could also flow from that relationship? Right? So singularly focusing on the problem is lust. So you're saying, okay, you can have homosexual contact. It's not lustful homosexual contact. Does that make sense? Or how could we read that very closely and very accurately, even in the context of 7th century Arabia, and say, well, how is that different from the way that we understand human biology, human love, human encountering today? All I'm saying is that you're entitled, absolutely, to the opinion, and some people argue that the Quran should be read in only its clearest fashion, but yet there's another statement by the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in which he says, if all the seas were ink, and you were to exhaust them writing words, you would still not exhaust the meanings of the Quran. So why should we only ever interpret it in a very narrow way that results in unhappiness? Why can't we challenge the ways and destabilize the ways that it's been interpreted to figure out ways that we can maybe maximize happiness and maximize the dignity of other people involved? Right? And so that's more the way that we would go after an interpretation that was excessively restrictive, perhaps, of that particular verse or other slide.
So by this, we mean that the problem is just lust, and if
well, that's what it says.
Love, then it's okay.
But that's what the text says, because it says lust. So
yeah,
why should we say anything else?
I'm not. Here it says lust.
Yes.
But.
It doesn't
matter.
That's the only one.
Adnan, can I say something?
Yeah.
I don't. This is my husband. I don't lust. Well, excuse me. I do lust him. Excuse me. Let's just. Yes, but I love him. So for me to look at somebody lustfully only, I do think that is sort of wrong. Because you take out what they all are besides beautiful, hot, just a pair of whatever. You're looking at them just objectively. So for me, I love him. And that's something different. It's not lust. And so what is really interesting to me is that my relationship with my husband is not just a sexual relationship. It's based upon love. It's based upon respect. It's based upon shared values. It's based upon wanting to have a family. It's based upon a bunch of different things. It's not just based upon whether I'm lustful for them. So it's also both based upon love. And also I would challenge the way that some interpretations of words within the Quran too as well, that I've been taught to as well, mean different things. Very different levels. 7,000 meanings sometimes of words. 70,000 meanings of sometimes of words or verses in the Quran. Meaning that I might read that verse and go, I'm not supposed to be looking at somebody just lustfully.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna talk.
If I may say one last point as well. Is that, and if we look very closely at that particular verse you're referencing, the question always calls to us is who is the audience and who is being spoken to in this particular example? Are you the Qawmi? Or are you Muslims, the followers of Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Muhammad? So that is addressed to the Qawmi Lut. That's a different people's entirety. I don't follow the Prophet Lot. Right?
The Prophet
so,
all say the same thing.
No. You have to be very specific. You have to be very specific. When you're doing close textual interpretation, you can't imply the extreme from the particular. So in the particular, it's saying lust.
In the particular, it's referring to a particular kind of contact, and in the particular, it's referring to a particular population.
Okay, you say that's wrong.
So I'm going to stop you. I'm going to stop you. You need to listen to me. Okay. As a gay Muslim man, I was born into a Muslim family, into a religious Muslim family. When I came to be aware of my own sexuality, it was a problem for me. I prayed to my God every night. I prayed that I would wake up straight. God did not listen to me. Let me finish, please. Okay? God did not listen to me. So I had to ask myself, what is this God, Yarrahman, Yarrahim, the most beneficent, the most merciful, the tenderly compassionate, the infinitely merciful, who made me gay and then just sent me to hell? Yes. Your classical theology, that's what it says. Right? Because that's what your extension of the story of God is. But I'll ask you something. In the story of Lot, the story is that these pretty boy angels show up at Lot's door and ask him for his hospitality. And what happens? A crowd of men gather outside and said, give them to us. Where is the consent? Where is the consent? There is no consent. They said, give us those men because we want them. Those angels, those men who were casting as men were not asked. Okay? So there's no consent there. These men who gathered outside the prophet Lot's door, wanted to rape them. They wanted to have intercourse with these men, irrespective of what the intention of the and the consent of the people that they of these angels.
I just want to add something up. I am a Muslim woman, and I do not have any problem with your interpretation of this particular verse, but what's the problem with this lady out there, that she's not native speaker of English,
okay.
So she's not able to explain herself.
I see.
Okay. So what I was being brought up with is an idea that being a homosexual comes from excellent. So does any other form of I wouldn't call it problem because that's an insult, but any other form of, that's my interpretation, and I again add up that I do not have problem with people being gay. But what she's trying to tell you is that classical interpretation of this says that it is a form of test from God to you.
Right.
And
except human sexuality is not a form of test.
Yes,
in fact,
exactly.
In Islam, sex between consenting partners is a form of ibadah, is a form of worship.
Yes.
Right? So why is it a form of worship for you if you're heterosexual and a punishment and a challenge for me as a homosexual?
Well, that's the thing about the
interpretation. And so the Quran also says that this is a practice. Now, the Quran speaks of animals, right, as ummas, as communities, as it speaks of human beings. So it speaks of the bees, for example, and it speaks of ants, and it says to us that these are also ummas, these are also communities. And in one of the verses in the Quran that speaks to the people of Lot says this is something that no other people have practiced. So do you honestly believe that the boys have not been doing boys and girls have not been doing girls until people of Lot? So you need to open up your understanding of history and context as well to be able to, and just not sort of respond to things out of context. Islam is supposed to be rational. And it is supposed to be, so when you talk about, oh, it's a test, well, your heterosexuality is not a test. You have an option. You have an option to get married and have halal relationships. Right? Where's my option? If you have that interpretation, it's denied to me.
Yeah.
So then I think maybe this God is not Rahman, is not Rahim, because this God discriminates. And that's not the God I want.
So my answer to that is that yes, and that's her interpretation.
Absolutely.
And she is okay with doing that interpretation.
That's
You're
fabulous.
Okay with doing your interpretation.
Absolutely.
You
and
know
so,
what I mean?
And
like,
so, what, so, but this is exactly what we're about, which
yeah.
is, you know what, we're not here to say that you're that she's
like,
a bad Muslim or that she's a bad human being. She's entitled to her opinion.
Yeah,
all we're saying is that we, there's a lot of people who, whether they're LGBTIQ or women or whatever, in, that are somehow marginalized, that are other, and that we also deserve to have a relationship with God, right?
Of course,
and
of course.
And that our spaces allow that, because your spaces sometimes are toxic and are spiritually abusive and spiritually violent for some of us.
Wait, just also
I
about,
actually,
yes, you may.
I just thank you. I see Maggie has her hand up, so I'd like to call on her as well. But I just want to take a moment to just make some observations about how this conversation has been going, because I think I want to thank you for intervening. But I think that when we talked earlier about why was it so hard to find a queer Muslim woman who was willing to be out in public in this space, I think what we're seeing here are some of the gender dynamics that can erupt even without us necessarily wanting to, right? That we're in a situation where we have cisgendered men who are doing a lot of explaining to the women in the room. And so I just
yes.
want to kind of challenge back a little bit on how
sure. yeah.
how that unfolded and see if we can find some different ways
yeah.
to think through that. I see Maggie has her hand up, so I'm going to
yeah.
ask her.
I just...
I want to say something too as well.
The story of Lot comes from the Hebrew scripture. And culturally, when a stranger comes to a visit, the cultural standard, which emphasizes hospitality, is that you sit in the middle of the circle in the village, and everyone is supposed to come and say, "Come and stay at my place and eat." So the breaking is actually the issue of hospitality. It's unfortunately, again, a patriarchal community within the Christian tradition and within the Jewish tradition has made it as if it's homosexuality. It isn't. It is that these two people that came to the middle of the village found no hospitality, but found aggression from the community. And it was only this guy, Lot, who took them in. So the breaking, if you look at the context of the story and the cultural context of the community, it isn't about homosexuality at all. Because the rape, I mean, the guy, first of all, which was an asshole, he said, "Take my two daughters and leave the two cats." Well, I have said bye-bye, thank you, I don't think I like your father. So he is willing to impose rape on his daughter rather than break the law of hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
It is the hospitality. Because in an area like Judea and the desert, if you are not
hospitable
and take
death.
A stranger,
it's death.
Yeah. You're dead. You're literally dead in the desert. So the issue is hospitality. Now, of course, we don't like the gays, and we like to have the women, and we like as white men. The result is that the issue of hospitality is broken. And of course, it sits very nicely. As communities in the Catholic Church historically, we didn't want the gay. We didn't want the lesbian. We didn't want the ones that are having sex. We don't want the ones that are divorced. So it fits nicely. But if the law is hospitality, then we can't tell someone, "You can't get into the church," or, "I'm sorry, you're Protestant. You can't come into communion." Do you understand how a beautiful story, and considering the guy was a twig, is totally screwed so that it fits what we like in power and way of doing. But it is supposed to be done. You're supposed to take care of the stranger that came to your meeting.
I
Just if I could make one quick comment as to in response to something that Sanaja had said. I think what you saw was us being triggered by the raising of a particular verse that is used quite frequently, quite aggressively. Mm-hmm. I don't think that person intended malice. I'm sorry that she left, but mm-hmm. I don't think that person intended malice. But the way that most Muslims ask that question is that the plain text says this, so how can you possibly claim otherwise? And that's because even though the plain text says lust, people aren't reading it. They're just not reading it. They're reading homosexual desire. They're not reading lust. They're not focusing on the particularities of that community, of that particular experience. And I'm not trying to rob her of her right to interpret it, but rather what I'm saying is that there's more than one voice on this. And that if you consider more than one voice on this, then maybe you can't be as sure as your particular on your particular perspective. And that's what it's more about. Like, queering for me is destabilizing the comfort zones that we have about these kind of things. She stated it so plainly so as to offend us in a way, almost. And I'm sorry that it escalated, but I think that's partially what was taking place.
But I think even and acknowledging what you're sharing there, I do think that it's something in the spirit of all of the conversation we've had this evening about creating open spaces, that we want to be mindful of all of the different kinds of defensiveness that can be triggered in this kind of conversation. I guess a good opening sort of position for us to take. So I said there are one or two more questions, and it's 9 o'clock, so maybe we could take one more and before we wrap up. I know you said you had to wrap up on time. Okay, so...
Oh, but this... No, later. Oh, later.
Okay, go ahead.
Helpful questions, sure. Helpful questions.
Hi, my name is Zahra. First of all, I want to say I really appreciate this conversation. I really love all the different issues and different backgrounds and perspectives you brought to this room. But more than a personal question or a religious point of view, I wanted to ask advice from you for a friend of mine who's not here. Number one thing I want to express, sexuality in our Muslim communities are not very well spoken of. Forget about homosexuality, even as a straight woman, I cannot speak about sexuality or anything with my boyfriend, with my father, with anything. No one gave me the talk or anything. Just almost like denying that this ever exists. I am against this myself. I am more of a person that's speaking, communicating more often. But I'm here particularly asking for advice. For a friend of mine, we both grew up in a very religious neighborhood, in a very religious community and families. I grew up going to religious classes and conversations every weekend, every summer, and with all the respect, with all the love and compassion I have for my religion, I discovered my own interpretation, as you all mentioned. So this friend of mine, his childhood friend, same as me, very spiritual, very religious, but in his late 20s, he came out and approached me. He lives in Turkey right now. He came and said, Zahra, I cannot live anymore. He was thinking about suicide. I'm like, what's wrong? His name is Jafar. I'm like, what's wrong, Jafar? He's like, I have this feelings and this thought that I have been suppressing for so long. And his family will never agree. The neighborhood we are coming in from will never accept. And the fact that his family is no family has such big pride, and the reputation in the city is very hard for him. So he came across this crisis in him for years that we have been communicating for years. He came about. He had two dead ends. Give up on his religion, on his family, on his country, which he did for a while, left to Germany, or he could not do that way. He said, this is not me. I love my God. I love my religion. I love my family. He came back to Turkey trying his best to, live like everybody else, like every other female. His mother was trying to set him up with females, and he's like, I cannot do this anymore. Now he's not engaged in any sexual act or anything. He's a very intellectual man. He came to this conclusion. He said, why? Me, as a human being, I'm not being recognized. I'm not being valued based on who I am. God masters, the old kinds of work experience, very spiritual, God-loving person, committing to suicide, and for years, psychological crisis in his head, poor young man. I'm asking for advice from you. How can I help him?
Where is he?
In Istanbul, right there. Germany, back.
Okay, so it's a...
Thank you, Ivan.
So your question requires a longer
answer.
But what I will say to you is that there are increasing presence on social media, on Tumblrs, where people are creating alternative communities and networks. And so, for example, for our mosque community, we have a global network. We've got 9 Unity mosques in North America. We've helped start other spaces in England and South Africa. But there are Tumblrs. There's a blog called I Am Not Haram. Muslims for Progressive Values USA has a great section on resources. Our Facebook group, other Facebook groups. So he can reach out and make community. I'm happy to give you my card and connect that way. An appointment with Google will also, find spaces and places on Facebook, on Tumblr, websites, and so on and so forth. And maybe that way your friend might be able to even find other people who live around the block from them. So, yeah.
I just want to say something I face a lot with my students as well. That's certainly a problem that my kids, my students see. And it's a tough one, and absolutely find the websites. And I would say what I often hear from my students who have graduated and returned is that having one person to support them makes a surprising amount of difference, maybe more than any one of us would ever realize. The fact that you're there for him is huge. And check out these websites and whatnot yourself. As we all know, there's a lot of hate on the internet as well, so certainly you could wander into those sites by accident thinking he's finding something more supportive. You're doing something amazing by speaking out, and trying to find this help for him and being there for him and being somebody he can talk to. He's obviously very comfortable talking to you. Make sure you take care of yourself as well, okay? Because I've been there. I know what it feels like.
Also, he was really more of a religious point because he was really feeling like because of the community's pressure and family values and things, he was really taught he's betraying on God. And I kept trying to talk to him and say, you're not, God is so great, God is so forgiving, God is so loving. I really just don't like from a very young age in our community by our elders, and that all the love and respect aside, we were taught how to fear God. But I tried to encourage him to remember it's actually about loving God. So as long as he was doing that, what is the point of feeling betrayal? This is why he felt not enough connection around him, because not everyone else, not all the other queers were on the same page as him. So he was not into, he was not into a relationship or anything. He was just discovering himself, understanding where he stands with religion and his identity, sexual identity. That's why I asked for
if you also want to just write one text down, a gentleman, a scholar by the name of Scott Kugel, has got a book called Living Out about the lives of gay and just of queer Muslims. And those narratives are really powerful because he may find his own story in those narratives and also the different ways in which people have resolved those issues from all over the world. The stories are from South Africa, North America, Europe, etc.
Canada.
Okay, a couple of years ago we had an interview where this man, we just did Umrah, so that's a lesser pilgrimage to Mecca. We did this with our family. At the end of the interview, he said, you haven't proved to me that it's okay to be gay and Muslim. What if on the day of your reckoning with God, God says it wasn't okay? And I looked into the camera and I said, when that happens, I said, you won't be there in the room. I said, my husband won't be there. I said, it's going to be a conversation between me and God. So actually, at that point in time, it won't matter what you think or what anybody else out there thinks. And I think what we're trying to say here, too, as well, with why we've made this community purposefully, is that we're challenging the way that we all interact with the thought of what God is. God, if God is closer to us than our own jugular vein,
God knows us. God makes perfection. We come from perfection. So spiritually, for your friend too as well, I think perhaps maybe your friend needs to think of God as larger than maybe his own interpretation of what God is. And perhaps what you just said too as well, God's way more forgiving and way more pluralistic in the thought of why we're made in different images, why we've come here to be gay, bisexual, two-spirited, or whatever we present ourselves to be. Perhaps we're limited in our translation of that too, yeah, as well.
So I'm just going to just riff off that. So we often say that God made us in God's image, but we also make God in our image. Right? We anthropomorphize, we masculinize, we make God in our image. And maybe the challenge is to transcend our own limitations when we understand God, and maybe love is the way to that. So,
okay, so one more question. So
my
last question,
I'm new to Halifax, and I also want to do some observations. I think what you expressed about your friend has been also expressed by many people in many different religions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my concern about a bit of how we're talking is because the focus is on Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I've taught in areas where it's predominant Christian, Roman Catholic. They express exactly the same thing.
Yes.
So I want to really make sure that we are not constructing Islam in a particular way, because I've already picked it up from this audience, this helping narrative. And I want to see, particularly from white settlers in the room, that are saying, that are falling into the savior moment as the discussions were moving on. And that worries me. So I think, first, I do want to really honor that this happened to you. This is a very difficult thing to put together. And you don't know who will come, what they will say, how they will interpret. The people who come to this talk, do they think about the role they're going to play as they witness queer Islamic, queer gendered encounters with each other? And again, I'm speaking as an ally to white settlers in the room, to really think about when you come to these events, where you're going to place yourself. Are you going to feel sad that the woman left? Are you going to see the homophobia that we're all capable of? And I came out to my family, and it was very loving. My mother gave my partner like a pendant she received on her wedding day. So I just really want to break that down, this monolithic moment. And in terms of having more, you know, looking at gender on a spectrum, I am grateful for the people who were on the panel to begin the discussion. But I don't want to make invisible white settlers in the room, which is what I think did happen. And white supremacy did not come up at all, for the reason why there was a tension that there was in the first place. So thank you.
Thank you
for sharing.
Okay, I think we are done for time.
We are impressing on our hosts.
But I really want to thank everyone for coming here and engaging with this. At times, very difficult, but very eye-opening conversation. And again, a big thank you to our